right, everybody. Let's take our seats. And we're going to continue. Thank you for your flexibility. That was awesome, right? Mike is like so great about doing that spontaneous. So he has slides and he'll continue. We have a full hour before lunch. If we need to go over a few minutes, I'm sure you won't want to be mind missing a couple of minutes of lunch. So good. I didn't think so. So Mike will continue. We'll do the raffle after. We'll do an extra raffle after the next break just so we can give Mike back the stage. So Mike, you're on.
Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
All
absolutely.
Right. Whew, this is more comfortable. That was stressing me out a little bit down there. Okay.
Ache.
You want to start? So everyone was in the room, but it was hard to hear, I heard. Okay. You couldn't hear anything. All right, so we're going to go through it. I'm not going to ask as many questions. There's my disclosures. Do represent Zymogen, and I do have a book on Amazon. There's my family, just so you guys kind of know a little bit more about me. So love to garden. I don't know, who's a gardener? Anyone in here? Love it. Awesome. So that's a great way to get grounded and also introduce new bacteria to your gut microbiome, which is, so it's a two for one, and it's you get better food. So there's my family, my daughter, and my wife. She's a chiropractor, and so let's talk about this. So we're going to go through the gut hormones, like we mentioned. So I'll just do a quick version, because I know a lot of you just heard some of that. The good thing, why talk about these gut hormones, more importantly? Because they're highly modifiable. So that's really important, because you're all clinicians, you're working with people, you want to come up with nutritional strategies that you can modify via lifestyle and diet. And the gut hormones are a critical mechanism. And they speak to the brain, so that's why, you know, part of this discussion and the theme of this conference is looking at the gut-brain axis. Okay, the gut hormones directly communicate to the brain. Okay, then we're going to get into nutrition ways to improve that and also talk about leptin. And I know a lot of you have heard about leptin, leptin resistance probably specifically, more in the context of appetite control and so forth. But leptin, I'm going to ask, who knows that leptin is a powerful inflammatory immune hormone? Okay, leptin is involved in pretty much every autoimmune disease you can think of, heart disease and so forth. Why? Because it's pro-inflammatory. We're going to talk about ways that you can modify leptin and why that's important. Okay? So, like we talked about earlier, bacterial diversity, and I mentioned Jeff Leach and all that. You know, we can talk about the gut all day long, but today we're going to focus on this little part of the gut, the satiety hormones. Okay? And I see a lot of you are writing down notes, which is awesome, but I have good news and bad news. The bad news is I updated the slides. The good news is you get access to them. So if you want to write them down, cool, but I totally rearranged everything, so sorry about that. But I added a lot of new slides too, and again, you're going to get access to that. So you might just want to focus there. So as someone mentioned, you know, digestion begins with the cephalic phase in your brain. Okay, so that's a very important I think, you know, we have routines. You know, people pray and meditate. People have their pre-workout warm-up. You know, you do these things before you read or write. Well, we should have a pre-meal routine. Doing heart math, like that, you know, like we did Dr. Rita Marie, the first session where we had our hand on our belly and our heart. Very important to do that before the meal. Why? You're going to release all salivary amylase and various enzymes and speed up the digestion motility process, and most importantly, activate the vagal nerve, okay? The vagal nerve not only primes the GI tract, the vagal nerve activates the anti-inflammatory response in your body. We're going to get into that. So it's arguably the most potent way to suppress inflammation. Who doesn't want to suppress inflammation these days? Okay, we all have a low level of inflammation in our body, and by managing your breath, you can reduce that through the vagal nerve. We're going to get into that. So your small intestine is a very metabolically active organ, right? It's as much of an endocrine organ as your pancreas is, as your thyroid gland is, as the testicles and ovaries are for men and women. Okay, because it releases, again, what are these category of hormones called? Incretin hormones. Okay, just please memorize that because you're going to learn. This is the new wave, by the way, for diabetic therapies. And also, I'm going to show you the future of neurologic imbalances, dementia, Parkinson's. All the research is going towards managing these incretin hormones. Because one of them right here, GLP-1, it's very anti-inflammatory in the brain. Okay, GLP-1 also affects the heart tissue. So it's lowered in high-risk cardiovascular disease patients. Okay. Now, I'm telling you this stuff, you're probably like, oh man, this is cutting-edge new information, right? Which it is. How long do you think we've known about this so-called incretin effect? Well, that was berberine. That's a great guess. That was a great guess. No, so this is research, is that 46 or 65? 65. So that's a long time ago. So this is what researchers found. A humoral substance, so some mediator, was released from the small intestine during glucose absorption, which acts by stimulating the release of insulin from the pancreatic islet ducts. Okay, who heard about this in medical school, nutrition school, chiropractic school? Not many people, okay? And so here's what the incretin effect is. Okay, if you're wondering, like, what is this? What does he keep saying? The incretin effect means that mostly GLP-1, okay, it's also stimulating insulin release. So, okay, food comes into the small intestine recognizes that and sends a message via these gut hormones, they're all listed here and in your notes, sends a message to the pancreas to help release insulin, okay? Remember, 50% of insulin's release is from these gut hormones. It's not just that blood sugar's rising. That's only half of the equation. The other half, and what's cool about that, you know, if someone is insulin resistant, as I mentioned, 20% of the adult population in the US, and it's actually dramatically increasing in children as well, is pre-diabetic. So these mechanisms are dysfunctional. And what I told you why we're talking about this is because this is highly modifiable through lifestyle, diet, and nutrition. Key point. So tons of great diagrams. You know, these gut hormones also speak to the fat cells, they speak to the brain, like I mentioned, the heart, all over the body. This is a great diagram. I have a YouTube video that goes into that. So, you know, 26 years ago, researchers figured out that, wow, these hormones are decreased in diabetics. So drug companies said, wow, what if we come up with analogs? They call them incretin hormone mimetics. Mimetics means they mimic the molecular structure. And they realized that, gosh, if we give these, first they had injectable, you know, so Januvia is one of them, Byetta is another one. They injected these hormones and found that, guess what? It improved blood sugar regulation in type 2 diabetics. But they also lost weight. They were less inflamed. They didn't crave as much. So they had, it's not just like, you know, the problem with the pharmaceutical industry, in a sense, is it's one drug for one problem, right? Like you suppress COX and LOX, but then you cause all these problems. What's cool is these gut hormones have all these off-target effects, which is pretty unique. And so that's why the drug companies are so interested in coming up with these different mechanisms. So I mentioned the L cells, which is right here. Okay, so these are the enteroendocrine cells, the endocrine cells of your gut. They produce and manufacture these powerful gut hormones. Okay, I know it's hard to hear down there, but who knows how we can increase the number of L cells via nutrition?
Fiber,
exactly. So prebiotic fiber is a great way to increase literally the number and quantity of L cells. That's a pretty cool idea. Now, your patients, how much fiber do they eat on a daily basis, on average? 19, yeah, not enough. That's the most important thing. So if you look, I mean, the paleo diet, the primal diet is really hot right now. If you analyze the fiber intake of primal paleo people living in Hadza, Tanzania, for example, how much fiber do they eat? Over 100 grams a day, okay? A lot. What about the children? So you've seen pictures of, you know, children in Africa with these big abdomens, and you think, oh, they have kwashiorkor, right? Protein malabsorption. Well, actually, this is researchers that are studying this right now. The bloated bellies are from the fiber. Seriously, so when you increase your fiber intake, and you're like, man, I thought I was gonna lose weight. Why is my belly? So you're fermenting, you're gonna fart, and you're gonna burp, and you're gonna do all that, okay? But that means your gut microbiome is being active, okay? That means you're increasing these L cells. And over time, as your bacterial diversity increases, and you change your gut composition through the nutrition, you're not gonna get the side effects of the belching and bloating and gas and so forth. So fiber is really important. This one, I think, is a new slide. Okay, this is very important. So the gut hormones also affect lipid signaling, okay? Particularly triglycerides. Now this is very important because as we get into leptin and the molecular causes of leptin resistance, you're gonna learn the intimate relationship between elevated blood triglycerides and leptin and why that's a problem. Because I'll just give you a hint now. When your liver and small intestine start to make chylomicrons, which are precursors to triglycerides, which you can measure in the blood, you can measure VLDL is a chylomicron-like particle. Okay, very low density lipoprotein, it absorbs bacterial particulates. Okay, so that's why elevated blood lipids are problematic and linked with issues. So actually LDL, this is off topic, but it's interesting. LDL actually neutralizes bacterial particulate. So think about that. Oh, someone has elevated LDL, let's just suppress it down. Well, what are you doing? You're you know, offsetting the buffering, the body's natural buffering response. Okay, so that's why you don't really see a direct correlation between LDL lowering and improved cardiovascular risk, right? Still, 50% of people that have low LDL still have a fatal MI, right? So there's a strong connection between the amount of leaky gut and bacteria that you're absorbing and your blood lipids, which is really profound. So if you're looking for biomarkers for clinicians, elevated triglycerides is a great biomarker. That's gonna tell you if someone is having this bacterial particulate absorption issue, also the gut hormones and it's going to give you a really good idea into the bacterial endotoxin load, okay? Now, this is off topic as well, but a lot of research is showing that non-fasting, meaning like having your patients eat a real meal, like kind of a, like a glucose tolerance test, right? Stressing the system and seeing how their blood triglycerides rise or fall. That's called it's emerging in research. So if a patient's not fasting and you have an opportunity to test their blood, it's a great window to do that. Because say their triglycerides are 300 or 400, then you know they really have a postprandial problem. And all the damage from food occurs in the postprandial state. It's not when you're fasting. So just as an aside, that's new research going. So we only have 49 minutes. So here's the future of the gut hormones. So we're looking at the brain, we're looking at the immune system, we're looking at the heart. Like I mentioned, right now, all the guidelines for medical professionals in prescribing these gut hormone mimetics and DPP-4 inhibitors, which I'm gonna talk to you on the next slide, are focused on weight loss and diabetes. But again, what's really cool here is, do you think people with a lot of belly fat, a lot of blood sugar issues also have neurological issues? Yeah. Right? Glucose damages neurons in the brain and leads to inflammation. So what's really cool is you can work on this now. We're really ahead of the pharmaceutical model in the sense, like we don't need to wait for the clinical trials to come out. We can just tell people to eat fiber, chew their food mindfully, exercise, and they'll have good effects. So remember I asked the question, how does bariatric surgery work? And everyone said, because it restricts how much food you can eat. Well, that's not true, okay? It's increasing these hormones. And so here's all the molecular changes in the gut hormone, gut-brain axis that are increased after bariatric surgery. Now there's different types of surgery and so forth, but it's important to look at PYY, GLP-1, and CCK, okay? Those are the main gut hormones. And so when you look at the pipeline of new diabetic drugs, they're all going after those gut hormones, okay? Now you might be wondering, okay, well, what do these drugs do? They inhibit DPP-4. You've heard of this, have you not? DPP-4, why do a lot of supplement companies sell this? Because it breaks down gluten. So I'm not saying it's bad or good, but here's what the research shows, okay? There's a lot of drugs on the market that directly inhibit this enzyme. Why? Because this enzyme degrades all your gut hormones. It's not a good enzyme. You probably don't want to take it supplementally, but if someone is eating a lot of gluten, fine on a short-term periodic basis. But here's this enzyme. Here's all the stuff that it does. It's very pro-inflammatory. It increases lipid synthesis, and it digests. Its main function in the body is to digest your powerful gut hormones that are already lowered in your patients and clients. Okay? So drug companies, again, are coming up with ways to inhibit this. So when I go to Whole Foods and I see this, the latest enzyme of the month, sitting there and I look in the back and I see it's DPP-4, I'm like scratching my head like, who's doing the science on this? So that's why I'm really passionate about you guys understanding this knowledge so that you can share this with people, because consumers want to take things because they heard it's good. But sometimes the science and what people are passionate and emotional about aren't congruent, okay? So just wanted to throw that out there. So just it's best to avoid gluten and not take these enzymes that may cause issues. Any questions so far? Mm-hmm. Actually, I think you already have this slide in there. The order did change a little bit. Okay. How's the pace? Too fast. Okay. I was wondering why I'm getting hot up here. I'm like, geez. All right. Okay, so remember when I talked about yo-yo diets and calorie restriction? Okay, and again, this came from none other than the New England Journal of Medicine, okay? So arguably, you know, a lot of family physicians and internal medicine doctors consider this to be the holy grail of research journals. So they showed that an 8-week low-calorie diet suppressed gut hormones for over a year after that just short-term intervention trial. Okay, so a lot of your clients are doing this. So again, eat real food. Don't worry about calories. No, you know, don't count calories. It'd be better to look at, you know, post-meal. If people, I love biometrics and data, stuff like that. A solution that's much easier and cheaper than counting calories is taking a picture of your food. Okay, this is something when I work with weight loss clients. No kidding, a clinical study, I don't have it here, shows that people that take pictures of their meals eat less food. And moreover, if you post it on social media, so I know that people, seriously, this is, I mean, right? So here's the science behind this, because you're making the private public. There's a great book on this called Switch by Dan and Chip Heath. this is a great way to have influence and so forth. And so you're kind of becoming vulnerable, if you will, right? So then you have an incongruent decision. For example, let's say I had a really healthy breakfast, avocado and eggs and ghee butter and all kinds of phytonutrients. And then for lunch, I'm with my buddies and I'm like, nah, I think I'm gonna go have a Big Mac and French fries and a Coke and stuff. Isn't that kind of incongruent with what I had for breakfast? So if you, when the rationale and the social science of this is when you post pictures of healthy food, you identify with being a healthy person. So you make decisions that healthy people do, okay? And people have been studying this. Why is CrossFit taken off faster than any other form of exercise ever in the history of the world? Because CrossFitters are very active on social media. They post their clean, their jerk, their deadlift, their form, what they're eating, okay, that it's community-based. I mean, there's many aspects to it, but if you go on Instagram, you're gonna find millions of videos and pictures of people doing CrossFit. So I would encourage you and your clients to start posting pictures and images and videos of healthy things that you're doing. Going to conferences, eating healthy food. It sounds silly, doing morning yoga, doing heart math. You'd be surprised, you might think it's stupid. Like I used to think, like, that's so stupid. Why am I gonna post a picture of like my yoga mat, you know, or something like that? But it really has a profound impact on the subconscious brains of humans, okay? So don't count calories, take pictures of your food, eat mindfully, eat more color. So here's that, here's a study. You heard about the vagal nerve. We did a demonstration of heart math, did we not? Great device, probably a device that out of the last 5 years of all these things I've been experimenting with, the one thing I couldn't live without personally, and has helped, you know, relationships, public speaking, everything. So I would highly encourage, if you haven't done it, please get the device and learn it. And so one of the ways, again, that these gut hormones work is via the vagal nerve, okay, the gut-brain axis. Do you have a... heart math. Yeah, so that was what we talked about earlier. So heart math. So basically, it's a biofeedback device that you hook up. I have it in the back. I could do a demonstration before we end here, but you already did a demonstration earlier. It's a poor man's way. I hate saying it like this. It's poor man's meditation in the sense that meditation is hard for some people to learn because you get these voices and, you know, thoughts, and you think that it's not working, even though that's part of the process. But with heart math, you get to see the light turn green. And then you realize, like, when you're in a parasympathetic state versus a sympathetic state. So I think heart math is really good. After you make the initial investment, it's virtually free. You just use your own breath, and you can do it anywhere, on an airplane, you know, on a train, what have you. Okay, so I think that was a tornado coming by, or? All right, we're good. So exercise is a great way. I mentioned this earlier. So we talked about, you know, a lot of people have confusion as to, like, when should you exercise and so forth, like for fat loss. Now, I don't have a slide on this, but the window for fat loss specifically is first thing in the morning. So one of the tips, okay, fitness, going back to Arnold Schwarzenegger and Lee Haney, bodybuilders of the 80s, if they wanted to get their body fat down to 3%, what they do, they would do cardio twice a day, first, both sessions on an empty stomach. Okay, so if people are like, gosh, I want to lose weight, what do I do? Go walking. You don't need a treadmill. You can walk in your neighborhood first thing in the morning with a little caffeine. So 100 to 200 milligrams of caffeine also enhances what's known as lipolysis. That's a splitting of fat cells. And you actually preferentially burn fat for fuel when you take caffeine before exercise. So it's a double whammy. Plus, caffeine actually blocks the stressful effects mentally of exercise. So it does all these beneficial things, and it preserves muscle mass, okay? So I know there's some negative connotation linked with caffeine. People are worried about adrenal fatigue and all this sort of stuff, but a small amount first thing in the morning helps get people going, and it maximizes the effects of exercise.
Sorry, how much did you say? What?
You can do, you know, 95 to up to 200. It depends. You know, I do green tea sometimes. Sometimes I take this supplement that has caffeine, co-crystal, called terostilamine, bound to it. Sometimes I do coffee. It just depends what people like. But a little caffeine can really give exercise a boost for people. Now, the other cool thing about exercise is it increases the gut hormones, okay? So here's where I want to provide a caveat. So morning exercise is good, but if people are like, oh, I'm not a breakfast eater, because we talked about skipping breakfast affects gut hormones. So that's the rub, and you don't want to make it too complicated. So here's my general advice, okay? If you can, exercise twice a day, Walk first thing in the morning. It can be 15, 20 minutes. It doesn't have to be an hour. Okay, walk, find some hills in your neighborhood, get your heart rate up a little bit, have a nice breakfast and so forth, and then do some resistance training. This is for elderly men, women, it doesn't matter. Muscle mass is in. Okay, it's anti-aging. We're going to talk about leptin in a little bit. Muscle is really important for reducing the inflammatory response. And actually, if you think about it, where does fat burning occur? In muscle. So if you don't have muscle, or if you have sick muscle because you're insulin resistant, you're not going to burn fat as effectively. Where does leptin dock onto? Muscle. Yeah. Where does insulin latch onto? Muscle. So the more muscle you have, the more you can buffer against 21st century chronic diseases, particularly inflammatory and diabetes type diseases. But again, I digress. Exercise increases gut hormones. Another way to increase gut hormones. Here's some of the research on chewing and mastication, I believe. Actually, you can't see these. I think that's what, yeah, that's my daughter eating kale chips. That's why I put it in. There's a key, there's a signal to me that this is about chewing and mastication. So again, how many bites per swallow was linked with increased levels of gut hormones? You guys are awesome. So I guess you could hear me down there in that hot room. Perfect. Yeah, I didn't have a slide on this. This was totally off the cuff. I love the question. The window for maximal anabolic effect is between 2 and 6 p.m. Okay? Now, what hormone is at its lowest point during that time? Cortisol. Exactly. Cortisol is good for muscle or bad for muscle? Yeah, I mean, I hate to say good and bad, right? But it can catabolize muscle. So the window of time that you're in your most anabolic state, both men and women, is between that time. So that's when I suggest for weight training and also neuromuscular activity. So the connection, like telling your brain to do complex movements, unilateral movements, standing on one foot and what have you, is most active during that time too. So your risk of injury from, you know, a mistake or dropping something or tripping or something is minimized during that window. Okay, and again, then we're gonna, you know, not feel the need to have this huge dinner like a lot of people do. You know, they skip breakfast, have a small lunch. There's a lot of crackling. Is that bothering you guys? Yeah, between 2 and 6 p.m. Yeah, and if it's 6:30, whatever. You know, just something along those lines, you know, in the afternoon. And again, this can be in your hotel room, or you can use a TRX, you know, the bands you can put on the back of a hotel door. Just something to induce some resistance training so you're affecting muscle tissue. Was it that mic? Huh. Okay, here's all the, this was a meta-analysis of all the research that has looked at how mastication and chewing affects gut hormones. So I just put this meta-analysis so you had the data there. And if you look here, this is not in your notes, sorry, this was a relatively new meta-analysis, I think published very recently. But it shows that chewing between, you know, is 30 and 50 bites per swallow increases gut hormones. So you have the data. There's a lot of good data of what grandmother told us, chew your food, you know. Don't be distracted and watch TV. So get off the iPhone, get off the computer. All right, so let's talk about specific supplemental ways that you can increase gut hormones. We talked about lifestyle stuff, exercising, breakfast, and so on. Pea protein. Who takes pea protein supplementally? So pea protein and also secondarily whey protein maximally increase GLP-1 and CCK. These are the two most powerful gut hormones that you have in your body. How does it do it? Why does it do it? I don't really know. This is research. There's two clinical studies from researchers at Duke University that have shown that pea protein increases these gut hormones. So they have the greatest effect on blood sugar regulation, appetite, and satiety. And we found this, you know, I found this clinically. When people take pea protein, like for a mid-afternoon snack or you know, between breakfast and lunch, they don't feel very hungry. It really does have a powerful effect. Here's another clinical study here that showed the same thing. So two studies. I think there's another one that was recently published on pea protein. Okay, so I'm just going to mention this now. Bitter compounds. I know, like, kids and some people just want white food, plain food. I don't want spices, cayenne, curcumin, and garlic. All these bitter compounds also affect gut hormone signaling. And that's probably why some of the research shows that berberine, because berberine is very bitter. Okay, berberine increases the gut hormone. So the more herbs and spices and flavonoids and things that you can put in your food, the better, okay? Also, this comes to salads, okay? So instead of just like spinach or iceberg lettuce, you wanna get radicchio, dandelion greens, okay? So not only are they rich in color and they have the phytonutrients, but they literally have bitter compounds that increase the levels of your gut hormones, which are really powerful. So that's really unique. What's another one that, Arugula, another great one, yes. We grow arugula. Mizuna, you guys use that one too?
Watercress,
great one. I'm not familiar with that one. Okay. Awesome. Love it. Yeah, you can do chicory as well. Yeah, radishes fall into this category as well. So chopped up radishes. So again, you can take an ordinary salad and spice it up a little bit and make it into a gut hormone boosting, microbiome boosting salad. And it tastes, you can make it taste good with olive oil and garlic and, you know, a little balsamic vinegar. No one would know the difference. You know, people often enjoy this, even kids do. So a lot of things you can do at home. So eating more color. So just interestingly, you know, blueberries are grown in northern latitudes. Why are they purple? But what is the phytonutrient? How does it protect it? Or what is it doing? So it's a way to prevent stress, ultraviolet radiation. So this is why Pinot Noir that has gone through like a water stress grown in California tastes really good, because it produces a lot of phytonutrients because it was stressed out. So, you know, ultraviolet radiation, so plants can't move around like we can, right? They don't have legs and cars and the internet and things like that. They're just stuck stationary, so they produce anti-nutrients that prevent herbivory and help them thrive in a lot of sun. And these phytonutrients, it turns out, fuel our gut microbiome and also have secondary antioxidant properties in our body. But they're poorly absorbed, so that's why berberine, for example, and I'm gonna get into the slide here, it's very poorly absorbed. So actually, people are like, why would you want to take berberine? It doesn't even get absorbed. Well, again, remember how I mentioned if folks went through medical school without learning about the liver, how they'd have to relearn everything? So forget about absorption. As long as it's coming in contact with that 100 trillion bugs that call the gut microbiome, it's having a biological effect on your body. So it's really important. So these, the purple here, the reds and oranges, those are called phytonutrients. Phytonutrients are very complex in their nature. If anyone just want to Google chemical structure of, say, anthocyanidins or proanthocyanidins, they're very complex steroid-like molecules. What turns out, you have different phyla of bacteria. The bacteroidetes love this complexity. So just by eating a lot of color, you can pivot the ratio and the from healthy or unhealthy bugs to more healthy bugs in your GI tract. So you probably heard of the Firmicutes, which are quote-unquote fat bugs. Okay, that's the phyla. They love simple, their molecular machinery is designed to break down like simple sugars and starches, okay? So that's why people that eat a standard American diet generally have high Firmicutes and low bacteroidetes. So you can pivot this in your patients by just eating more color. So it's pretty powerful. But the other beneficial effect of eating color is color, these phytonutrients, increase gut hormone release, okay? So they do a lot of things. So we're gonna get into that. Here's berberine. Only have 30 minutes and we still have a lot to cover, so I'm gonna go a little fast. Here's a chart. So green tea, berberine, any color phytonutrient is arguably beneficial. You know, if someone has a negative effect to it, then that may not be, then obviously change things around and or look for a different source or something. But there's a lot to choose from. There's a lot of variety here. Resveratrol, you've heard of this for anti-aging properties, right? You know, the mice study at Harvard with David Sinclair. Well, guess what? It increases GLP-1. Curcumin does as well, and my favorite, berberine, okay? So again, some of the early research papers said, yeah, I don't know, even though berberine does all this cool stuff, it's poorly absorbed, so this was literally written about in medical journals, right? Even though it's better than metformin at improving blood sugar, it's poorly absorbed, so we might have to tweak with the molecule to make it better absorbed. Like, well, because you're forgetting about that big organ called the microbiome, okay? So this is affecting the microbiome and the gut cells. So here's all the research, all the clinical trials. I think there's 6 well-designed, randomized, placebo-controlled clinical trials showing that berberine is really effective for improving blood sugar regulation. Again, just skipping through that. Here's that one reference to 1,500 years ago. Okay, this was written in a book. I'm having a hard time. Note to the elite physician, is that right? So don't worry about absorption. You know, even think about that for curcumin. Because curcumin has a lot of benefits, but then people say, oh, it's poorly absorbed. But again, you have the microbiome, silly. Those 100 trillion bugs are more metabolically active than your liver. So these phytonutrients are affecting the liver. So how does berberine work? It turns out, and this is for those of you that love the pathways and to geek out, you've probably heard of AMPK, adenosine monophosphate kinase. It actually also increases mitochondrial biogenesis. This is the target of metformin. This is how metformin works, by increasing AMPK. When you increase the number, quantity, and the metabolic enzymes in your mitochondria, you make your cells and tissues more metabolically healthy, so to speak. So this is what research is showing, is that guess what? This pathway, and I'm just including this so you guys understand, you know, so you, if you hear it later, affects GLP-1, which is pretty cool. So there's other nutrients like alpha-lipoic acid. There's things like L-arginine. There's other nutrients like pterostilbene that affect AMPK. And we've talked about them in the context of mitochondrial health, but it turns out that there's some link between potentially mitochondrial health, at least their signaling pathways, and gut hormones, which I think is particularly exciting. All right, so let's get into endotoxin. I want to talk to you about fiber a little bit, and so there's other properties, you know, in the colon that are important about fiber, and you've heard of short-chain fatty acids. So when you eat fiber, your gut bacteria, you know, metabolize them and kick off these short-chain fatty acids. There's three, you know, butyrate, acetate, propionate, and so forth. And the molecular biology gets a little complex. Like in one study, we'll show elevated acetate in an overweight person. Another study will show elevated propionate. It gets a little confusing. So I've talked to a lot of experts on this, and what you want to focus on is butyrate, butyric acid. Now I'm just going to pause here. Who's heard of ketogenic diets? Okay. What's the main ketone body? Beta-hydroxybutyrate. It's very structurally similar to butyric acid. And that's why I think ketosis is so powerful, because butyric acid, which is one of the main short-chain fatty acids, makes our DNA more stable. It's involved in chromosomal stability. It's what's known as, it gets complex, but in epigenetic mechanism, it's a very powerful thing. So that's why we see so much neurological benefit, weight loss benefit, metabolic benefit when people go on a ketogenic diet. Okay, it's because the main ketone body is so similar to the healthiest short-chain fatty acid produced by your gut bacteria. That's topic for another discussion. But just want, if you guys want to learn more about this, and I know we talked about this morning, you know, getting into research and getting on the internet, go into Google Scholar and type in ketones and beta hydroxybutyrate. You're going to be blown away. Okay, blown away. Okay, so this is how fiber is good. So butyric acid and short-chain fatty acids also affect the gut hormones in the colon as well. So this is why fiber is beneficial. Okay, gonna go here. Just kind of summarize. So exercise, chewing your food, eating breakfast, not restricting calories, eating fiber and phytonutrients, berberine, pea protein. Okay, you got this in your notes again. Those are all the ways that you can nutritionally intervene and cause the same metabolic shift that is ascribed to bariatric surgery, which is pretty cool. So I think everyone should know this information. Okay, it's brand new, it's hot off the press. Again, the drug companies, all pharmaceutical companies are going after these gut hormones, which is powerful stuff. All right, so any questions before we kind of transition into leptin? Yes?
You talk about chewing food, and I think we all get that chewing food is important, and I've heard Dr. Rita Marie say, if you don't have time to chew your food and have a proper meal, like have a blended meal. Mm.
That is a really good question. I'm so, yeah, for the live streamer. So the question was basically, does having a smoothie, a pre-blended smoothie or soup of that sort, does that affect the release of gut hormones because it's already pre-masticated, in a sense, right? And the release is that, this is Duke, remember I showed you Duke University looked at pea protein? Some of their research was they did intra-duodenal administration. So the answer, again, inferring from that research is it doesn't matter. Okay, that doesn't mean swallow your smoothie in 30 seconds, take your time with it and allow things to come in, but as long it has more to do with, you know, the cephalic phase, so being present, okay, being mindful, having the food contact the mouth, but also if you have a lot of bitters and herbs and fiber and good protein sources in the smoothie, that's beneficial. And so other studies have looked at soup. People consuming soup. Soup's like a smoothie, right? You just have it with a spoon. And they've shown an increase in gut hormones as well. So I think smoothies overall are good, but just make sure that people aren't just like loading bananas and papaya, you know what I mean? But it becomes just a sugar bomb. And so I think making sure that a smoothie is an excuse to just have more vegetables because you can stick all kinds of stuff in there and it's ground up. Awesome question. Yeah,
So do you not believe in intermittent fasting as well, since it hasn't, does it have the same impact as long-term fasting?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Okay, I think periodic intermittent fasting is good. okay? Because there's so many anti-aging benefits, but here's where I'm gonna throw in, refer back to ketosis, and I hope we could talk about this more at another time. When you're in a ketogenic diet, you mimic calorie restriction biochemically. So here's the thing with intermittent fasting. I think it's good, but again, skip dinner, not breakfast. So what a lot of people do, and this is popular in the paleo online community right now, is they skip breakfast, they skip lunch, and have this massive dinner. And I can't tell you how many times I've sat knee-to-knee with an overweight individual in a medical setting with Gerard Giller in Colorado, and that was a pattern that many people that I worked with did. Okay, so I don't think that's beneficial. But again, everyone is so biochemically, epigenetically, everyone's microbiome is different. If it works for someone and they're lean, and encourage people, you can get a glucometer off Amazon for like $20, okay? So, you know, testing their blood sugar pre and post meal afterwards, when they wake up, like how does their blood sugar levels read? How's the body fat percentage? So that would be my solution to that. And I think, but periodic fasting, bowel rest, there's some really good, naturally this would happen again in primal paleolithic times, right? But again, I think it's better because you don't want to burn muscle at the expense of quote unquote intermittent fasting. And when you go throughout your day with no protein, no fat, what does the body do? It actually wants to keep fat on board and will preferentially burn skeletal muscle, which is what you don't want. Okay, so let's kind of transition. So we're going to talk about adipose tissue and where it comes from and why belly fat is so important. So research has actually shown that individuals with intestinal permeability and inflamed intestines actually start to develop fat around their intestines called creeping fat. Who's heard of this? Some, yeah, to protect. And guess what? If you biopsy creeping fat, it's loaded with immune cells. It's very inflamed. So what we see is, you know, looking deeper, this fat is not subcutaneous. This is fat, omental, creeping fat that's, you know, really there probably from intestinal damage. And a lot of research actually shows this, and I won't get into the studies, but intestinal permeability is linked with elevated, correlated high degree of statistical significance with elevated blood sugar. The marker zonulin, which you'll probably learn more about with Dr. Tom O'Brien, zonulin, a marker, again, of intestinal permeability, is directly linked with increased body fat and increased blood sugar, okay? So you can empirically look at your patients, if they have a waist circumference, you know, elevated body fat, particularly around the abdomen, and elevated triglycerides and blood sugar, they probably have leaky gut. Again, this is the Public Library of Science plus one biology. It was May of 2012. I have it all in my book. I'm not gonna get into the details here. So a big belly is an inflamed intestinal gut, okay? So how does this happen, okay? And are they related? Are they correlated? Like, what's the mechanism here? I'm gonna kinda go into that. The mechanism has to do with endotoxemia, okay? I know you've heard about this. For anyone that's done a rotation in the emergency room or a hospital type setting, you've heard of sepsis, right? Which is a total perforation of the bowel. But endotoxemia is slightly different than sepsis. It's low-grade sepsis. It's sepsis occurring all the time, albeit at a lower intensity, okay? So every single person in this room has around 5 grams of endotoxin in their GI tract at any given time. 5 grams. The difference between metabolic syndrome and someone that's metabolically healthy is the integrity of the lining of the gut. That determines how much of that 5 grams is coming across. Okay, so you've heard of E. coli. You know, any gram-negative bacteria, who had chemistry class at any one point in time? Remember the gram stain? Okay, that's gram-negative. Well, that's looking for gram-positive bacteria, I believe. But gram-negative bacteria, such as E. coli, harbor this endotoxin. This is arguably the most pro-inflammatory substance that the body recognizes. The most, like an animal, if you read anything related to Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or driving inflammation, a lot of laboratories use endotoxin to mimic that, okay? That's how pro-inflammatory it is. A lot of your patients have elevated blood levels of endotoxin all the time. So they're inflamed. And this is what causes blood sugar to dip and rise. This is what causes, again, LDL cholesterol. It's an endotoxin sponge. That's what it does. Just go, don't take my word for it. Go into PubMed and type in low-density lipoprotein and endotoxin. You're going to be blown away that the cardiovascular research has missed this very important aspect. So the lipoproteins are really protective mechanisms to neutralize gut bacteria that's translocated from the lumen of the intestine into systemic periphery, okay? So again, is it a good idea to just drive down someone's LDL levels if it's neutralizing this bacteria? Probably not, okay? You wanna get at the root cause first. Now, incidentally, statins are also anti-inflammatory. So that could be, you know, part of the reasons. But anyway, So let's dive into this endotoxin deal a little bit more. Okay, so here's your gram-negative bacteria. You have how many grams in your gut?
Five.
So that's a lot, by the way. If that was all of a sudden in your bloodstream, you would probably die. That's what sepsis, septic shock, is from endotoxin. So on all your immune cells, your innate immune system, your macrophages, your dendritic cells, you have these things called toll-like receptors, TLRs. Okay, you've probably heard this before. They have a lock, and the key that fits right in very nice and tightly is called endotoxin. Okay, this is like throughout the entire animal kingdom. This endotoxin toll-like receptor 4, this is what they call in evolutionary biology, a highly evolutionary conserved mechanism. So we've been exposed to this for a long time, and our body has figured out ways to sense it so that it can send messages to the body that something bad is going on. Okay, and our ancestors didn't have access to McDonald's and fast food and junk food, right? This was also a factor in tuberculosis and cholera and stuff, which is a topic for another discussion. But the way that leaky gut causes metabolic perturbations is by first activating the immune system and then causing insulin and leptin resistance. Okay, so that's what I want you to know. There's all the complex biochemistry. The way that poor gut health translates into belly fat, diabetes, is by first activating the immune system through intestinal permeability. Okay, so a portion of that 5 grams of endotoxin comes through, stimulates immune cells. Endotoxin, by the way, if you hear LPS, lipopolysaccharide endotoxin, they're synonymous words. So you're gonna see that in the research. So you might be wondering, okay, how can I measure endotoxin in my patients? I mentioned earlier, triglycerides, waist circumference, body fat percentage, and elevated blood sugar all correlate with increased endotoxin, okay? Now, there's other factors like persistent organic pollutants and loss of sleep that can also affect those parameters, but if you just look at what a person is eating, if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, is it a duck? Probably, right? So a lot of people, if you're eating, you know, this meal, pizza and junk food, have antibiotics, you're gonna have elevated blood levels of endotoxin. So what's really unique, though, is you don't have to have overt intestinal permeability for endotoxin to come in. This bacterial particulate has figured out a way to hijack your chylomicrons. Okay, so the way that these micelles and so forth, chylomicrons, in the intestine, so when you eat a high-fat meal, particularly of the longer-chain fats that are found in processed foods, endotoxin gets in there. So there's actually a clinical study. Well, I guess I didn't look at So clinical studies have found that this is one of the main mechanisms to get endotoxin in, okay? So just want to put a caveat on here. This isn't avocados or grass-fed butter. This is a lot of the soybean oil and canola oil. The processed oils, the fried foods, are what dramatically increase micelle formation because they're longer-chain fats. They need micelles to be absorbed. And when that happens, this stuff's coming through. So that's why I love serum triglycerides as a really cheap, inexpensive biomarker when you're looking at people. Because most people, even if you don't have access to labs, whatever, someone can go and get their serum triglycerides measured and you can kind of see what's going on. So again, if they're elevated, they're probably absorbing this nasty stuff, which is the root cause of their issue. Here's the lipoproteins. I forgot I had this in here. Sorry, I talked about it a bunch of times. So it's right here. So LDL and HDL are endotoxin sponges, most specifically LDL as well, okay? Again, here's all the research on endotoxin and diabetes. Talk about it, in the book Belly Fat Effect. I'm not going to go into any of these in any detail, but do you think this is a fair amount of research? Yeah. These are all well-designed, randomized, placebo-controlled studies for the most part. So again, you have leaky gut, damages the gut, endotoxin comes in, latches on to these innate immune signaling receptors. That leads to metabolic dysfunction. Who's heard loss of metabolic flexibility? You've probably heard this, like this is a Jeff Bland type of thing, So people are stuck in sugar burning mode. They can't burn fat, right? And that's because inflammation is at the root cause of that. So then we're gonna get back, and we talked about the treatments already. It turns out that a gut hormone happy diet is also a low endotoxin diet, which is really neat. So you don't have to memorize any new dietary strategies. The phytonutrients, the fiber, chewing your food, eating foods with color are great ways to neutralize this. It turns out there's a lot of research, and I just threw this in there when I was first building these slides because the focus of this whole conference is gut-brain axis. Well, it turns out that when you're psychologically stressed, guess what happens to your intestinal lining? It becomes permeable, okay? So I know people have comfort foods, But if you're really stressed out, you probably don't want to have pizza and a Coke, okay? Because a lot of that endotoxin is going to come in. So this was research in combat, individuals under combat, and they looked at their intestinal permeability. So there's a huge link there. What's really cool, though, is there's an enzyme called alkaline phosphatase. For those of you that are familiar with looking at labs, you probably see this on your labs all the time, alk-phos. It's kind of in the liver, the bun, and so forth category. Alkaline phosphatase neutralizes endotoxin. You know how we have the phase one and phase two detox enzymes for environmental toxins? Alkaline phosphatase is an endotoxin neutralizer, okay? So you're like, well, how can I increase alkaline phosphatase? Butter, pumpkin seeds, I don't know why. I thought this was interesting in the research. Garlic was one, and I'm drawing a blank on another. Fiber in general was another one. So fiber, butter, pumpkin, and pumpkin seeds. Pumpkin and pumpkin seeds. That's a really good point. I forgot about, yeah, zinc and alkaline phosphatase. Yeah. So there's a lot of research showing that. Now, conversely, grains, phytates, suppress alkaline phosphatase. Okay, so things that are going to be commonly found in a standard American diet. Okay, so we want, I mean, who eats pumpkins or pumpkin seed butter, pumpkin seed? Periodically, they taste really good. Kids love pumpkin seed butter, and you can make it yourself. So a really easy way to get in not only all the beneficial effects from the pumpkin seeds, but also increase this enzyme. Okay, now I'm going to go through this study a little bit fast because we need to link in leptin to this whole conversation, because leptin is a powerful way that the gut and the brain communicate. And guess what? This is a molecule that drives leptin signaling. Endotoxin stimulates leptin signaling. Okay, that's what you need to know. The biology is a little complex, but there's a huge molecular link. And this is a clinical study. This was an interventional trial, okay, that showed that when you have metabolic endotoxemia, it drives this complex word called suppressor of cytokine signaling 3. Okay, this drives leptin. This is at the molecular cause of leptin signaling. So again, leaky gut, poor food choices, processed high-fat diets, damage the gut, you absorb this nasty particle, and it drives leptin signaling. So you might be saying, okay, well, why is leptin so bad? I've heard of leptin resistance, right? Who's heard of leptin resistance? Probably all of you. That's the tip of the leptin iceberg. Leptin, the reason why I'm so passionate about it and want to share this information, leptin is more of an immune signaling molecule than it is an appetite, regulatory molecule. Okay, it affects a very critical cell, which I'm sure you're going to hear this afternoon with Dr. Tom, called the T regulatory cell. Who's heard of this? Okay, these are the policemen of your immune system. Okay, inflammation, for example, in your brain, or what have you, right? Say you hit your arm or damage your arm, the way that you're going to get restoration and the suppression of those immune signaling molecules as the injury heals is the T regulatory cells. They're really good. Well, in autoimmune disease, we have an increased prevalence of these TH1, again, I can't even see, I'm thinking I'm looking at the right slide, TH1 and TH2 type, T helper cells, and a reduction in the Treg cells. So the immune system is just doing its thing, but the Tregs are not there to turn it off, okay? Leptin suppresses Tregs. Leptin suppresses Tregs. This is very, very critical. So anyone that has elevated body fat percentage, above 25% for women, 20% for men, they're at risk for having an autoimmune disease or chronic low-grade inflammation because the immune system doesn't have its normal braking mechanism because there's no Treg cells there. So I talk about this in the book, not a lot of research here, but every autoimmune disease you can think of, metastatic breast cancer, high mortality of breast cancer, is linked with leptin. But you don't hear about leptin often, right? You hear, because it's, a lot of people don't understand all the immunological research regarding leptin. So very, very important to look at this regulatory connection. So in fact, this is a kind of a question here for y'all. Is obesity an autoimmune disease? Okay, so there's five defining criteria of an autoimmune disease. Obesity meets four of the five, right? So the only criteria of an autoimmune disease that obesity does not meet is the immune system does not make antibodies directly against adipocytes. If it did, obesity would be an autoimmune, not a metabolic disease, in terms of like medical specialties. But that being said, because it almost is an autoimmune disease in a sense, there's chronic inflammation, and this is, and again, why I wanted to teach all this information to folks is any weight loss therapy that doesn't also simultaneously address the immune system probably will not be very effective, okay? So that's why you see a lot of these effective weight loss therapies are also addressing the immune system. The gut-brain connection, the heart math, Tai Chi, meditation, yoga is addressing the immune system, meditating, being calm, and so forth. Curcumin, flavonoids, these are affecting the immune system. So it's really important that, you just have that in the back of your mind so that people understand that it's not just exercising calories, okay? You also have to look at the immune system as well and chronically eat foods that are anti-inflammatory. And it turns out that those foods also feed the gut microbiome and help the whole thing. So the solution to the answer is relatively simple, but the complexity is all interconnected and woven. And so what's really unique is if you biopsy fat tissue of overweight individuals, there's a dramatic increase in the number and quantity of immune cells in the fat tissue, about 5 times, okay? So these immune cells make home into the adipocytes, and that's why people can't burn fat. Why do people just hold on to this stubborn fat? You're like, you know, they're doing all the right stuff, right? But if they're not addressing the immune system, then these immune cells don't go away, and the metabolic flexibility is stuck in sugar burning mode. So that's a really important point, and leptin facilitates this. Why? Treg cells. Okay, the reason why we get so many immune cells in fat tissue in the context of obesity is because the Treg cells are not working. Okay, so curcumin, resveratrol, vitamin D. I'm gonna talk to you about another novel hyaluronic acid formulation that improves this ability to affect the Treg cells. Those are really good for weight loss as well. So kind of blend what's successful in autoimmune disease and blend what you know about weight loss together and combine those two. Okay, so we're almost done here. How are we doing? Good speed? No? Little fat? Little, okay. Well, I just wanted to show you that leptin dramatically increases with body fat percentage, okay? So a lot of people want testing. I wanna test if I'm leptin resistant. I wanna do that. You can really do this non-invasively and look at body fat percentage. Again, the number is around 20 for men, 25 for women. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're at 26% body fat, you're at all this high risk. It just means you're somewhere on the spectrum and you could have this runaway inflammation occurring. Fat on fire. Okay, and I just want you to know this. This is a very early event. Okay, these fat cells becoming more inflamed occurs as children gain weight. This is one of the first things that you're going to see. So the fat tissue inflammation and this leptin signaling and all this, you know, nasty stuff is occurring in children early on. Okay, so this is very, so that adult that is sitting knee to knee with you that's been overweight or obese their entire life has probably a lot of this going on. So that the impetus means to really look at the anti-inflammatory side of things and work on leptin signaling. Yeah. That is a really good question. Well, I mean, I would say great question for the live streamers, and thanks for tuning in, by the way, live streamers. The question was, how much does genetics play into this? And if you look, you know, our genetics haven't really changed that much. Childhood obesity back in the 60s and 70s, even autism, wasn't even discussed. So we're seeing a dramatic increase in all diseases. And the age at which children, I assume that's where your question was going, I'll address the adults in a second. The age at which children are getting formerly adult onset diseases is being lowered and lowered every year, okay? So the onset of type 2 diabetes, this was exclusively an adult disease, yes? Like 20 years ago. We're now seeing children that are insulin-dependent diabetics. So my answer to all this thing about genetics, it plays at most 30%. 30%, okay? I mean, clearly we have genes, you know, the ability to store fat has been beneficial for humans, otherwise we wouldn't be able to do it anymore. You see what I mean? It would have been washed out through the gene pool. So there's some benefits there, but our environment is dramatically increasing how much fat we store. You know, changes to our gut microbiome and gut ecology and so on. So even if you look at cancer, I just went to a cancer conference this past weekend, Jeff Bland put on, and cancer, which has, you know, researchers used to think there was a high degree of genetic concurrence there, they're saying at most 30%, okay? So it's really the environment and epigenetically, okay? So our environment hasn't changed, but the way our genes are read and expressed and the transgenerational effect that environmental toxins have on epigenetics. So that all these diseases that we're seeing may be use of DDT and dioxins, and you know, the chemical industry has been largely unregulated for a very long time. So it could be that epigenetically we're seeing these manifest from all the toxins that our grandparents and parents were exposed to, which is kind of scary. But again, what's really cool is butyrate, that short-chain fatty acid, works epigenetically to restore normal methylation patterns. B12 and folate and so forth do as well. Curcumin, resveratrol work epigenetically. So it doesn't mean we're doomed. The epigenome is very malleable and is changing over time. All right, so let's just, this is more of the same. These are kind of summary slides to show you that leptin is dramatically linked with increased fat gain, and that's also linked with inflammation. Now here's what's, there's one slide I want to show you. This is what's really powerful. Okay, when people gain weight, they don't just gain a couple of new fat cells a month, it's in the billions. Billions and billions of new fat cells are gained as people gain the average 10 pounds per year. That's a lot. Because I don't think I mentioned it, but where is leptin released? Fat tissue. 99% of all leptin in your body originates from fat cells, adipocytes. Okay? So one of the main ways, obviously, is to get rid of the source, endotoxin triggering leptin release and formation, get people exercising and moving, but there's another nutritional way that you can affect fat cell signaling, okay? Through hyaluronic acid, so I'm gonna kind of show you this. We have 3 minutes left here. So here's, I should have put this earlier. So, you know, leptin has two personalities, the metabolic and immune, the T-rank cells, gonna get into, I wanna talk a little bit about, is this adiponectin over here? I don't have my glasses on. Does anyone see adiponectin or is it not on there? Adiponectin is inversely correlated with leptin. Okay, it's not. Oh, okay. Adipo. So, like adipocytes, adiponectin. It's inversely correlated. This is protective. So, your fat cells release all these hormones and cytokines and signaling molecules. Leptin is pro-inflammatory. Adiponectin is anti-inflammatory. One way nutritionally to increase adiponectin is through taking fish oil, taking omega-3 fats. Out of all the research, there's a lot of herbs and things being studied, but fish oil is one of them. So that's, incidentally, I looked at fish oil in the context of weight loss. Fish oil takers, when they exercise, they burn more fat than non-fish oil takers. When fish oil is exercised, they preserve more lean muscle mass than non-fish oil takers. So there's some really good benefits to fish oil, not just lipid lowering and so on. I would look for IFOS certified. So, you know, the fish oil has kind of been a commodity up to this point, and so there's been a lot of people that are looking at, you know, dioxins and not putting out good products, I should say. So IFOS is the International Fish Oil Standards Group. IFOS. Yeah, I-P-H or I-F, I-F, I-F-O-S, sorry. IFOS. So they have a website. So what I would do is you can go on there and just look, and you can ask the manufacturer of your fish oil to see if they're certified. So this is a third-party group that independently looks at oxidation, peroxynitrates, and heavy metals, and even nuclear fallout from Fukushima, which is pretty unique. And then the other thing I would look at is enteric coating. Enteric coated fish oil has better effects on the GI tract. In fact, again, I remember New England Journal of Medicine published a study in the turn of, it was I think 2001, 2002, showed that enteric coated fish oil had a greater ability to offset intestinal permeability. So that's what I look for, IFOS and enteric coated. Here's all the links. This is in your slides, by the way. This one, the leptin and breast cancer. So breast cancer is on the rise, very scary. We're seeing a lot of younger and younger women get breast cancer. Well, guess what? Leptin affects all kinds of aromatase pathways, cell growth factor pathways, it affects the immune system. So there's a huge link between elevated body fat, leptin, and breast cancer. So even more, you know, impetus to get this under control. All right, so here's what's really unique. So I did a lot of research into supplements and natural ingredients that can affect leptin signaling and fat cell signaling. And there's some data here, some there. One I'll mention, alpha-lipoic acid. Okay, high-dose alpha-lipoic acid, 1,800 milligrams, has been shown to reduce weight by 5% over, I think it was an eight-week trial. So there was no diet change, no exercise change. This was research done in Italy. So fish oil I mentioned, alpha-lipoic acid, and then there's another hyaluronic acid, glycosaminoglycan product, that this comes from research in Spain. And so what they found is that they found that fat cells, you can affect the stem cell. So I mentioned that there's like 2.6 billion new fat cells being made when people gain weight. every 8 weeks, which is a lot, right? So if you can perturb this, so what these researchers looked at, they looked at all these different cell growth factors involved in adipogenesis, which is the formation of new fat cells. And what they found, here's kind of the key molecules here. So here's your stem cell going to make the adipocyte. What they found is that, and I'll show you the clinical trial, is that when you take hyaluronic acid, glycosaminoglycan, okay, you can actually pivot the stem cell conversion away from making fat cells and instead make chondrocytes. Okay, so there's two important factors here, okay? Chondrocytes do what? Help with cartilage, okay? Is there a higher prevalence of articular issues and osteoarthritis in overweight people? Very high, and so then you have achy knees, achy joints, so people don't want to exercise because it becomes painful. So you can simultaneously reduce the painfulness of exercise via improving joint health and reduce how many fat cells are being made. Okay, so this is a clinical trial right here. This was actually conducted in the Midwest at University of Michigan Medical Center near Detroit. So what they found is that a combination, so here's it's a branded ingredient, you'll see it, Oral Visc. What it's been shown to do is reduce synovial fluid and serum leptin and also the inflammatory cytokine signaling, and in so doing, improve body composition and also mobility, which is pretty unique. So it's pretty interesting, but osteoarthritis, for example, is highly prevalent in overweight individuals, as I mentioned. But here's what's really fascinating. To sink home this osteoarthritic, it's not just the musculoskeletal system that's stressing the joints, it's more metabolic, it's leptin. For example, when people lose weight, their osteoarthritis in their hands improve. You're like, well, if it was just from the sheer amount of weight that they're carrying, it would just be the knees and, you know, the hips and so forth, not the hands. Who's walking on their hands, especially an overweight person? Probably not. But so it turns out that by reducing fat cell signaling, reducing leptin, reducing the inflammatory response, you get a systemic-wide reduction in inflammation. That's why osteoarthritis is reduced there. So this is published on PubMed. You can, you know, learn more about it. So again, Oral Visc is the ingredient. And really honored to speak with you guys about this. Sorry for all the confusion and the tornado and all that sort of stuff. That was kind of interesting. I was trying to make eye contact and speak loud with all of you all. So we cover this in just 59 minutes, which I was worried that we wouldn't do in 90 minutes. So sorry for going fast, but at least you got all the content. You can get the new slides. We'll talk to Dr. Rita Marie about how you can get that. Love to connect with you. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I have a podcast and blog, High Intensity Health. And if we have time for questions, we can do that. So thank you.
You said there was a product that had both GAGs and hyaluronic acid. Mm-hmm. What was that?
It's called Leptin Manager by Zymogen.
Hey, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the alkaline phosphatase levels, if they are high, then that generally indicates that there are endotoxins. So
alkaline phosphatase, it digests endotoxin.
Right.
So you want it to be high.
So you want it to be high. So as practitioners, if we see labs coming back where they're outside the functional range and the levels are high, does that indicate that they are healthy, or does that indicate that they actually have high levels of endotoxin?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say you also want to look at it in the context of BUN, urea, and things like that, because a high alk phos, high normal, isn't always healthy. It could be some early liver congestive issues and stuff like that. But I would just look at more maybe low alk phos as a sign. Okay, zinc, like okay. We mentioned, pumpkin seeds, butter, fiber, and things of that sort.
So that's the marker, the low alk phos that you're looking for, more or less.
Yeah, and then if it's high normal, just make sure it's in the context and the other, you know, liver function tests and biliary tests look okay.
Super.
Yeah.
I've always been a big supporter of fish oil supplements, but there's been some information out there about increasing prostate cancer. So have you looked into that? Do you know the pros and cons, pluses? No. Okay.
I haven't looked at that, actually. Yeah. No, I haven't. I know there's always controversy on both sides of the equation, but I just, you know, the exercise research really shows the benefit.
Okay. And then you said fish oils, omega-3, but what about algae oil and other kinds of omega-3s?
Yeah, that's a great source. I mean, for the vegans and stuff like that, again, you just want to make sure it's clean. Mm-hmm. There's only one manufacturer of algae fish oil, and that's Martek. You know, so, and they have different versions of raw materials you can buy, so you just want to make sure it's you know, clean stuff.
Okay, this goes back to the first part of your talk. Like you were saying with the, like, eating the things that might cause fermentation, mm-hmm. and you're saying just go ahead and eat them, and eventually it will work it out.
Yeah.
There's I have a 79-year-old person mm-hmm. who has LPR and then had aspiration and got pneumonia and then had antibiotics and then got SIBO.
Mm.
And, okay, so she was looking at the fermentation potential of everything she ate, got way down to like 84 pounds.
Wow.
And now she's adding things back in. But so she's gotten up to a quarter of a cup of blueberries. If she has anything more than that, she loses everything, not just the berries.
Mm.
Everything, but and it's painful.
Right.
But should she just go ahead and?
Yeah. So you don't want to cause pain in someone. So here's what I would suggest: if you Google the Elemental Diet by Dr. Pimental, he's a SIBO researcher. So that's what I would suggest, and it's pretty restrictive. But it sounds like her diet right now is restrictive anyway. So to help with the SIBO, because I think the combination of the Elemental Diet, Dr. Pimental, I think he's at UCLA. Or USD, he's down in Southern California. So he developed this protocol, and I guess they sell this medical food, but you can do it without the food, just like amino acids and things. So basically what you're doing is you're starving out. So SIBO, you know, with antibiotics and elderly age, you're getting a leakage through the ICV valve of bacteria from the colon into the small intestine. And so that's overly fermenting foods and causing, you know, systemic issues, right? So that's where I would go with that. And then also maybe you can start with a blender or food processor. So take cooked food, blend it up. You can do dehydrated kale chips or breads of the sort to get those vegetables in, but maybe the raw stuff could be a little much too. But I would first do the SIBO, do as much as you can there, then start reintroducing foods.
So just a follow-up, if she can do the quarter of a cup, is she getting the nutrients from that?
Not if she's getting all the diarrhea and stuff like that. And
not with a quarter of a cup.
Oh, yeah, I mean, as long as it's not causing any issues. Yeah, and then you could work up to a third of a cup and half a cup and so forth. Yeah, but SIBO's tough, and it's so individual. Good question. Thank you.
Hi. Well, one people ahead of me both asked questions that I was going to ask, but I'll thank you. But I wanted to ask you, for patients that have, like, a lot of loss of cartilage in joints, bone-on-bone issues, how effective have you seen these products be for somebody who are that far gone?
Mm-hmm. They've been really effective clinically. I've had all kinds of feedback. I mean, I can, tout for myself. I do like CrossFit, handstand push-ups and walks, and had chronic elbow pain. Within weeks, it was totally gone, hasn't come back. But for people that have had like meniscal tears and, trauma and things, there's a certain level that supplements can take. But the whole idea on the science, and particularly the raw materials I was telling you about, support synovial fluid. Okay, so you're increasing the lubrication, kind of like getting like fully synthetic motor oil in your car. So it's more viscous and so forth. So when you do these movements, you're going to minimize the friction.
Thank you.
You got it. Thank you.
It's hard to pick out which question I want to ask here, mm-hmm. but I'm going to pick out this one. Are you familiar with Uwe Ravenscoff and his work?
Yes.
How do you believe? I mean, you think his theory on atherosclerosis and LDL and the bacteria is a pretty strong hypothesis?
So I believe he was the one, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. I haven't looked at this in a long time.
Yeah.
That really looked at macrophage infiltration inside the endothelium. I believe so. The macrophages, if you remember that diagram where I showed you. You have your intestinal lining, the single cell layer called the endothelial lining. Endotoxin comes in, macrophages are getting triggered, and they go systemic. Macrophages, if you look from any immune cell throughout the body, they're the most widely found throughout the body, by the way. In the brain, they're called microglial cells. in the liver, they're called Kupffer cells, and they communicate to each other. So you have leaky gut, have this endotoxin coming in, macrophages, then they're speaking to the brain, and that's why gut inflammation is often linked with brain inflammation. Then we see non-alcoholic fatty liver develop from leaky gut. So I would, again, I don't know.
What I'm going to say is he says that LDL is, as part of its immune system function, basic, it's, you know, the, one of the early immune, I mean, it's the, our basic immune system is LDL, you know, attaches to these,
macrophages.
You know, yeah, or no, the bacteria. They're, and toxins also as part of your immune system, and then it gets stuck in the endothelium, and that's what actually causes the plaques to grow rather than coming from oxidized, you know, and then it becomes oxidized. So you're not real familiar with that.
No,
and that's his hypothesis, and it was pretty strong. I thought it was a pretty good hypothesis.
Yeah, so basically what he's shown is LDL becomes modified or oxidized, and then it gets engulfed by the macrophage. The macrophage gets stuck.
That's not what he says. He's contradicting.
Okay.
No, you don't know. It's okay.
Oh, that's
then
fine.
Let me
yeah.
ask you a question that you probably do know.
Okay.
That's okay, because you're just not right up on that one.
Right, okay.
But what about, okay, you think CD14 receptors that, you know, the LPS, that's one of them, they're co-receptors, the toll-like one, I think it's a toll-like four.
Right.
Are
toll-like
they
receptor
equally,
four. Yeah.
Are they equally as important?
Yeah, I think they're co-activators, co-receptors, so they're frequently found that correlating. So you see elevated blood endotoxin, and or you're going to see the CD4 level. So it's actually one of the markers that they use, the CD14.
Okay, I just wondered, because I wrote a paper and I focused on the CD14 rather than the toll, but I put it to you, the toll one.
Cool, thank you for the question.
Two questions. One is, what is the impact after of taking amino acids from kind of liquid form after exercise versus eating? And I'm relating this to growth hormone and gut hormones, I guess, and the timing involved, because it seems like we're kind of maximizing here the gut hormones, but then we study a lot on the growth hormones for fat metabolism as well. So can you share your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's an awesome question, and thanks for asking that. You know, there's a lot of research in the amino acid world, and here's what the studies actually show is intra-exercise, or like during exercise or post-workout, is really important for maximizing MPS, or muscle protein synthesis. This is what we want, and it actually goes down with age. So as you become older, it becomes harder and harder to recover from your workouts, and that's why high-intensity workouts are good throughout the lifespan. Obviously, you don't want to induce injury and low back injury with squatting and things like that, but really important. So amino acids are key there, and the ones that you want are branched-chain amino acids. And actually, there's a way to increase the absorption of the BCAAs by adding histidine and arginine, okay? So that's, oftentimes you see BCAA products with glutamine. But guess what glutamine does? It actually reduces the absorption of leucine. So there's a researcher, I think it's Dr. Wolf, from here in Texas, that has published a lot of research on amino acids. You can look at him in PubMed and has helped, you know, create some of these formulations. So it's a really important point, especially for middle-aged elderly people. Amino acids are key. And so, I mean, I grew up working out and worked at a gym and was a personal trainer and stuff like that in high school and college. You know, high school boys, like right after they work out, they have the protein shake like ready to go. But adults were like, yeah, I just worked out, I'm going to get a cappuccino and go drink a glass of wine. Like, you know, that's the wrong thing you want to do, because guess what? The kids can probably get away with that, but the adults can't. You really need, and I'm talking to adults, I mean all of us in this room. Okay, after you work out, like in the car, you need to be like a high school football player and just slam that thing down. It's really important to increase muscle protein synthesis. And so it doesn't affect growth hormone levels from the research that I've seen. Growth hormone and testosterone boosting, which are awesome, is more contingent upon the intensity and the volume of exercise. The higher the volume, the higher intensity, the more growth hormone and testosterone you're going to release. It's not. It's going to help with recovery. Yeah, it's not going to negate anything. And there's a meta-analysis, if you want, I could share it with you. They looked at all the clinical studies on growth hormone and anabolic effects of exercise and so forth, and they recommend, it was in the conclusion, high-volume, high-intensity exercise, full-body movements, squats, deadlifts. You don't need to go super heavy, but that full-body movement, the more muscles you can activate at once, the more growth hormone you're going to release. And leucine and all those essential amino acids help with recovery. Yeah, so timing, like during workout or right after. The other caveat is you want to take these amino acids in a supplemental form away from food.
Oh, right.
So that's... Right, right.
Right. Yeah, and away from carbs specifically, because that'll raise the insulin, which drops the growth hormone, which defeats the purpose.
Great question.
So I can't do omega oils, flax, fish, chia, hemp. So where does that leave me with getting those things?
Yeah, can you eat like soaked nuts and seeds? Like can you do Brazil nuts and walnuts and things?
Yes, minimally. Like if I overdo that, then I break out in cystic acne when I eat any of those. And it started with the fish oil. So I went to flax, then I couldn't do flax, and I was just eating as much fish as I could. Then I couldn't eat fish, so then I went to the plant-based. Then where is that coming from?
I don't know. I'm just thinking off the cuff. I would maybe take bile acid supplements, work on getting the bile going and moving. And we could do a whole presentation on bile, by the way, and how important that is. But I would maybe look at that. Maybe there's some fat malabsorption issue, which is creating inflammation that manifests systemically, because there's no protein in these, at least the fish oils, that you should, there's no protein there, so you really shouldn't be getting like an immune response, hypothetically. So yeah, we'll look at supporting bile and maybe massaging the gallbladder and stuff like that, and eating, in your, the circadian rhythm of the gut, we didn't get to talk about it, but the maximal window for bile release, pepsin release, and motility is between 10 a.m. and 4, so that's your gut clock. Right? And so that's when digestive output, enzyme output, motility is at its max. So maybe try and eat your fats during that window too. Just thinking out loud.
All right. Cool. Well, thank you. Everybody bring out your wands and let's give Mike a super duper round of applause. Whee!
Thank you. That was fun.
That was awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. That was good.
Was that awesome? Yeah. So his book, The Belly Fat Effect, is pretty amazing, and it's got a lot of that science that he talked about. You will have all the slides are on the digital, so if you have your computer with you, go back to your room, you can download those. All right, what else? Okay, so for people who are in NEPT, raise your hands. All right, we're going to have a private lunch, and I don't know where. It's in the DeWitt's Colony. Same buffet, so you go to the buffet, and then you bring your plate down the hall to the left. Okay? And then for everybody else, you can tell them about whatever.
And everything else, we did not forget the raffle. We'll do double raffle double since raffle. We had a tornado raffle
right.
when we came back. So we'll do double raffles when we come back. So we are due to meet back here at 2. So what time will we come back? 1:55 would be great. And Maria will lead us in some movement at that time. We'll be ready for Tom O'Brien, and we'll do the raffle.
So okay. We'll get started right away. So
that's right.
Yay, thank you.
Enjoy.